Since 1985, Stuart Peterson has offered strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at stuart-peterson.com.
From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason out of the office today, so no update to the commodity markets. However, this is our Ag Finance special. We'll talk with the folks at Compeer. That's the brand new system of farm credits across northern Illinois, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. We'll also take a look at Farmer Mac, how it interacts with Compeer, and how it's the secondary lending institution behind many of the banks that help farmers put a crop in the ground. And we'll do all of that right here on this edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, lending support to generations of farm families for more than 100 years. Whether a young farmer or a seasoned grower, Farm Credit Illinois offers financial products and services geared specifically to the agricultural community.
Hey, just a reminder for this Monday afternoon that I am out of the office on vacation all week this week, so no update of the commodity markets during the closing market report. However, do check out my Twitter account at Commodity Week, and if you don't have an account, you can just follow that online. The address on the web is twitter.com/Commodity Week. That's twitter.com/Commodity Week. I give you that for one important reason. While I'm on vacation today, there was a delay, at least Friday afternoon, in what we thought would be the release of the $12 billion tariff compensation package from the Trump administration to farmers, and the details. Those were delayed until today, supposedly, and if the numbers have been released, and I've been someplace during the day, that I'm capable of seeing them and getting them updated on my Twitter account. You can find them again. They're at twitter.com/Commodity Week. Otherwise, I hope you have a great week, and I'll be back talking to you about the commodity markets, not on Monday, because next Monday is Labor Day, but frankly, on Tuesday of next week. You have a good week, and stay with us.
Support for agricultural weather on WILL comes from Busey, empowering individuals with financial education through their resource center. For online calculators, planning checklists, and articles, visit Busey.com.
The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. Find us online. Listen to us on demand anytime you would like. The address is WILLAG.org. Let me take a moment now to thank you for listening to our ag programming. Thank you. I mean it. Really, thank you for listening to the programming. And just as a reminder, here's what you hear each and every business day. We start at 8:55 a.m. with the opening market report, including Aaron Curtis, Pete Manhart, Bill Gentry, Ellen Dearden, and Bill Mayer. And then an update at 10:58 a.m. with five other voices, Joe Vaklevic, Greg Ginder, Merrill Crowley, Chip Nellinger, and Steve Georgie, followed up at 12:58 each and every business day with Sue Martin, and then, of course, the closing market report, including our analysts Kurt Kimmel, Wayne Nelson, Jackie Vakes, Dan Zwicker, and Mike Zuzalo. And we wrap up each week by recording Commodity Week on Thursday evening. You can hear it at willag.org that night, or on Friday afternoon at 2:36. Oh, and don't forget that we also have a whole series of regularly scheduled analysts during the closing market report for weather. Those include meteorologist on Monday, Mark Russo, Tuesday, Don Day, Wednesday, Drew Lerner, Thursday, Mike Tenora, and on Friday afternoon, both Jim Angel and Eric Snodgrass. WillAg.org. We think it's one of the most comprehensive places that you can find information about markets and weather and agricultural news. Oh, and thank you. Thank you so much for listening. This is the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. Do find us online at WILLAG.org. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Out of the office today, this is our Ag Finance Special. The farm credit systems in northern Illinois, Wisconsin, and Minnesota have combined recently to create Compeer. Jace Wagner is the CFO, or the chief financial officer of that system. I spoke with him at the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention in Kansas City, Missouri, and asked him just how the merger was going.
Yeah, the merger came together on July 1st, 2017, and the three institutions have come together pretty well. The foundations of taking care of clients, understanding, and being part of agriculture in the rural communities really brought us together pretty quickly. We've integrated some of the back-end systems and now working on those client-facing items and hoping to bring those together throughout the rest of this year and in 2018.
So what are the things that you talk mostly with farmers about? I suspect that they're maybe twofold, some about land and purchases and loans, other about crop production loans, and I want to take those up by region and how they might differ, and then about crop insurance as well, maybe as a way to secure the loans.
Yeah, so we tend to look at the whole package. So a farmer needs to make decisions based on their whole operation. Most often, corn and soybean cash grains farmers would have an operating line with a farm land loan. We want to offer that full suite of products. The crop insurance is an important crop risk management piece for the farmer. It also does help support the operating loan, but primarily it's a way for that farmer to manage his overall risk. Managing that interest rate mix and the amount of short-term debt versus long-term debt is another way to manage their overall risk. And we look at where interest rates are today, having short-term rates really pretty close to long-term rates. We expect to see some movement, farmers locking in those longer-term rates to allow them to manage their risk long-term.
As you looked at all the data that came from the three states, were there very many differences that you could see in the well-being of producers?
Producers across the spectrum were in pretty solid spots. We did see more stress in the Minnesota area as they had bad weather in 14 and 15. We've seen more of that bad weather extend into the Illinois area in 16 and in parts of 17 as well. So we're seeing some variation. All that usually evens out over time. Certainly the basis that we're experienced in Illinois are much stronger than what you're going to see in southern and many parts of northern Minnesota and Wisconsin. So we see some differences there. That's appreciated and recognized, and we look forward to having that diversification in our portfolio.
How are the assets of producers holding up after 4 years of lower incomes?
So the biggest asset that we have is land values. Those land values have moved down in a very moderate way. We continue to see some 10,000 plus land sales out there. So good land is selling really well, and that's a good sign for the market. Machinery seems to have hit a bottom. The individual operations within the equipment is aging a little bit. Well, we expected that. Most people upgraded in that 2010 to 2015 timeframe. So we're in a pretty good spot as it stands today, but the asset values are dropping a little, which is okay and expected.
How much of a difference is there from a central Illinois land value to a primary production area in Minnesota land value?
Yeah, so we definitely see some differences. A lot of that is driven a couple reasons. One, you have a different buyer base, so you have anti-corporate farming laws in Minnesota, so you see a less of an investor bid than you might see in Illinois, which keeps prices up. But really that quality and that consistency is stronger in Illinois, and so you see typically about a $3,000 per acre difference. You can see as high as 12. That same land in Minnesota may sell for, you know, 9. And then, you know, if it's 10,000 in Illinois, so a lot of times that would be 7.5 or 8 in the Minnesota area. And those differences are borne out in the yields and the basis that you can get. So we see that consistently over time.
Just to clarify, the $3,000 an acre difference, you quantify as the investor difference, or is it a combination of things?
Oh, it's really the economic difference. You do see an investor base which provides a deeper investor buying community, which will tend to hold prices up longer and be more stable. So it's not necessarily a premium price that they're paying, but it is more of a deeper market that will keep prices more consistent over time from that investor base.
So it's about the stability of the marketplace then?
Correct. Yeah, that investor base will, more buyers typically supports a stronger overall base, and so that's what we're seeing. It's a minor difference in the broad spectrum, as we still have a really strong base of buyers within that farming community. But as you look out over time and economics get tough, that investor base is going to be supportive.
I want to go someplace different, because you do work with consumers and you do make home loans.
Yeah, we make support our rural communities through home loans. Many times those rural communities are ignored by the banking institutions, the large mortgage banks, and so we're there to support those loans. If they fall out, we offer both secondary market Freddie Mac, Fannie Mae products, as well as specialized products for your individual farm, where you may have outbuildings, a small farm operation associated with that as well. So we do the whole spectrum of home loans and try and provide products that match our producers' needs.
Would these be available to consumers in rural communities too?
Absolutely. That rural community aspect is where we support. So if they're an urban person that wants to live on a hobby farm or in a rural community, that's absolutely part of what we do, and we would welcome that customer into our fold.
How's that defined? I mean, not the customer, but the rural community.
Rural community, so a home loan, if you're in an actual community, has to be $2,500 or less. But if you're outside of a community, an unincorporated area, we can do all of those loans. And many of those hobby farms are just outside of town within those unincorporated areas. And so we do a lot of that. We do over $1 billion of that type of lending. And so we are a major provider of credit in that market.
What things, coming back to the merger, do you believe Compeer will be able to offer because of its larger size?
Yeah, the scale benefits that you get are around specialization and around diversification. And specialization in particular, we are able to leverage some of our home mortgage knowledge that we've had in different areas into the areas that maybe haven't been as better served. We also see a lot of hog barns going up around the country, support those. We have a dedicated swine group that's available to offer that expertise out to that farmer who may be looking at that for the first time. Same with poultry barns. Dairy expansions, those type of environments, we're able to leverage that expertise we built up in certain areas across the full spectrum.
Oh, so your northern farm belt roots really show.
Absolutely. That northern farm belt is where we are. It's where we love. We've grown up with these people. We've been in partners with them for generations, and we really want to measure our relationships in generations over time, and expect to continue to be there long term.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jace Wagner is the Chief Financial Officer for Compeer. I spoke with him during the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention in Kansas City, Missouri. Compeer is the new name for the Farm Credit Service banks that service Northern Illinois, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media. Find us online at WILLAG.org. There we post most of our agricultural on-air programming in its entirety. You'll also find news and notes and information along with the latest from the United States Department of Agriculture. Weather updates, too, all there at WILLAG.org, WILLAG.org. And don't forget that you can listen to us as a podcast if you'd like. You can find us in iTunes, Stitcher, on TuneIn, the NPR One app, and one of my favorite ways, using the Google Home. That's right, just ask for the Closing Market Report when you talk to your Google Home. It's all part of the service that comes to you from the Urbana-Champaign campus of the U of I. This is our Ag Finance special. Let's continue now with our conversations carried on at the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention in Kansas City, Missouri. A representative from Farmer Mac, a secondary lending institution, was on the floor. I caught up with Jackson Takish and asked him about the rough 4 years that producers have had across the nation and what their situation was like today.
You're exactly right. So the profitability picture is not the best we've seen. So it's been 4 years of tight margins, 4 years of tight profitabilities. And that means that farm financials don't look as good as they once did. Fortunately, the bankers and lenders out there are hanging with their producers. So the demand for greater needs for financing have been largely met. If you look at all the call report data from banks, from Farm Credits, to look at our financials, you see that people are out there lending, they're extending those lines of credit, and they're trying to meet the needs that farmers feel they need on their balance sheet to try to support these lower levels of income. That helps farmland, right? So we don't see the types of foreclosures or sales necessary to support any sort of a liquidation of farmland like maybe we experienced in the 1980s. And I think having that open and transparent dialogue between the producers and their lenders has helped keep that conversation going. And any sales that we do see, there's somebody on the other side willing to buy it.
What underpins the differences at this point that allows that to continue and not look like a 1980s? Things that may have happened during the run-up, things that are in place maybe from the government at this point in time?
There's a couple of things that I'll point you to. First is the level of run-up in the most recent period. It was a fast run-up, but it lasted for a lot longer. So producers were able to build a better balance sheet, to save up a lot of money, build up some working capital to sustain an extended downturn. That didn't really happen in the 1970s. It was kind of up and down very quickly, and then we went from a high to a low in about 6 or 7 years. So we don't see that now. It's been a much softer landing compared to the 1980s. Two, I'll point to interest rates. Interest rates in the 1980s went sky high. The late 70s, 80s went sky high. Farmers were highly leveraged. They had a lot of debt on the land itself, and that created some pretty solid increases in cash flows necessary to sustain their debt levels. We don't see that today. So while absolute debt levels are about the same as they were in the 1980s, you have a much lower debt requirement. So the amount required to service that debt is much lower than it was in the 1980s. You've got lower interest rates, and you were able to finance out up to 30 years. There's products on Farmer Mac can offer its borrowers and the lenders out there out 30 years. So you can finance your farm with a 30-year AM now. And that didn't happen back in the 1980s.
I'll make note that University of Illinois agricultural economist Gary Schnittke also suggested that farmers were, while paying very high prices for farmland, not paying as high a price as what might have been indicated as the financials at the time. So that probably was helpful. I'm also wondering whether crop insurance has made the current time frame for lending easier.
100%. I think both farmers and lenders showed a lot of restraint this run-up. So farmers weren't paying outrageous prices. They weren't paying as high as the cap rate might have indicated that land was worth to your Dr. Schnittke's points. And lenders weren't lending that much. They weren't willing to go as high as they were in the 1970s in terms of loan-to-values or advance rates against that land. So a big deal. And then crop insurance, of course, there's a much higher participation rate in crop insurance today than there was in the 1980s. It was virtually zero in the 1980s. So that allows, during tough times, that revenue to be offset by those crop insurance payments. So you may have a good yield but low price, and that you could still see a crop insurance payment from that, whereas 20 years ago that didn't happen.
Farmers are likely interested in know certainly how to deal with their local banks, maybe even with Farm Credit, but how do they deal with Farmer Mac?
So a lot of times farmers don't even know that we're in the picture. So we operate very much in the background. We work with our network of lenders across the country to offer our products. So we're a long-term capital provider. We're looking at the real estate. So we're in it for sometimes up to 30 years. So the bank offers our products to their customers. The customer deals with the bank. So the borrower's working with their bank. They might not even know Farmer Mac's part of the picture. So we increase the options out there for producers. We increase the amount of time in which they can repay their loan, and we lower the interest rates all at the same time. And I encourage every producer out there to ask their lender, do they offer Farmer Mac? Do they work with Farmer Mac? Because we can increase the options that they have at their disposal.
This at one time, and I don't know today, was a government-backed or funded program. Is that still the case?
So we are a government-sponsored enterprise, but under no conditions do we accept any money from the government. We're not funded by the government. We're a publicly traded company, so we are self-capitalizing through capital markets. We issue debt every day in the capital markets, the same as the Farm Credit Funding Corp would. But we are a completely separate entity from the Farm Credits or the government. So we do have an implicit guarantee from the government, but we are not government-guaranteed in any way.
Do you think now is a good time for producers who are well capitalized to invest in farmland?
Well, I'm a believer in agriculture. I think the future is very bright for ag for the next 50 years. I think we're set up more so than any other country, to produce safely, soundly, and sell our products at a great rate. So I'm a believer in agriculture. Now, does that mean someone should buy or sell land? That's a really personal decision. It depends on the finances and the conditions in the area. There's a lot of X factors there. But I am bullish on agriculture for the next 50 years. So take that for what you will.
Jackson Takish is with Farmer Mac. I recorded him at the National Association of Farm Broadcasting Convention last November. This month, USDA released some updated numbers for cash rent. I caught up with Gary Schnitke from the U of I last week and asked him to review those numbers for me.
Yep. So they released their statewide level for cash rents in Illinois. And again, they'll release county level yields every other year. So next year will be the county level yields. But this year, cash rent in Illinois was pegged at $223 per acre. And that happens to be up by $5 from the 2017 level, which was $218.
This was not what you expected or wanted producers to do last year.
No, I'm a little bit surprised that cash rents went up. Again, we're looking at a situation where the returns on the situation may cause for iffy returns. But, they went up a little bit, $5 per acre. And again, that would be the first time they've went up in a number of years. We've been seeing price declines on cash rents since 2014. So first year we've seen one of those go up.
What does this tell you about the farm economy in the state?
So if you're looking at 2018, there's a reasonably good chance that we'll have a profitable year in 2018. And what's contributing to that, there are three things will have to be in place to contribute to that. One is exceptionally high yields, which USDA says we're having. So 207 bushel corn yield for Illinois, that's all-time record. So if that happens, that'll help income. If some farmers did some pre-harvest hedging, got some higher prices on soybeans, say a third of the crop, that will help. And then there's a market facilitation payment coming, which will be released here fairly soon, and we'll have more detail on that. But that could be above $20 per acre over both corn and soybeans. And if that happens, that will help incomes in 2018. The real concern is 2019, and that year is when we'll be looking at tough cash flow positions for farmers to be looking at.
And this is because it's likely that carryouts for both corn and soybeans, if we have a normal growing season in 2019, will either grow or stay very large in the case of soybeans.
That's exactly right. And obviously we're looking at cash bids right now for soybeans below $9. And if you were looking at a budget for 2019, you would probably be putting in a $9 soybean price rather than what it has averaged for the last 4 years, which is $9.75. So take 75 cents off the price, and that'll lower returns to soybeans, and soybeans turn unprofitable if that happens. The other thing that's happening in 2019 is that costs are likely to rise. We've seen fertilizer cost increase. So, for example, right now anhydrous ammonia bids are above $500 per ton. That was compared to $400 per ton this time last year. So those increases in cost, and those are mainly associated with energy price increases. So fertilizer is highly related to energy prices, drying, and fuel. All of those look to be going up, so we're going to have a year where we're, rather than looking at $9.75 for a budget price, $9 and higher prices, our cost, excuse me.
That, of course, is Gary Schnitke, agricultural economist from here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. This is the Closing Market Report for Monday afternoon. I'm Todd Gleason.
It's the Feast of St. Monica, patron of homemakers and housewives. On this day in agricultural history in 1859, Colonel Edwin L. Drake drilled the first successful oil well in the U.S. near Titusville, Pennsylvania. The drilling hit oil at 69 feet 6 inches when under the derrick floor was seen a dark film floating on the water. In 1874, Carl Bosch was born, a German industrial chemist. He directed the development of the industrial scale processes for production of ammonia from atmospheric nitrogen. He eventually won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry for devising chemical high-pressure methods, like that which produced ammonia out of nitrogen and hydrogen gases. In 1879, Sir Rowland Hill died, an English educator. He was the inventor of the penny postage system, with the first adhesive postage stamp in 1840. In 1928, the Kellogg-Briand Pact was signed in Paris. It outlawed war and provided for the peaceful settlement of disputes. And in 1998, former U.S. Agriculture Secretary Mike Espy was charged with accepting more than $35,000 in gifts from companies that did business with USDA. He was eventually found innocent, but seven others were found guilty of similar charges. And that's This Day in Agricultural History.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason on this Monday afternoon out of the office, and I will be all week, so the Closing Market Report will not have an update of the commodity markets and the trade in Chicago for this week from the CME Group. However, we do have some really good shows put together for you. I hope you enjoy them. They should show up on the website as well at willag.org, willag.org. I'll be gone all this week. Next Monday's Labor Day, so we'll come back with some new shows for you on Tuesday, a week and a day from today. Now up next, we'll dip into the archive for a series of stories this week on the story of corn. At the time of the recording, Forrest Troyer, who's since passed on, it's been 7 years looking into the domestication of corn into the United States. Corn was first domesticated in Mexico between 4,500 and 7,000 years ago along the 18th parallel. It was flint corn. Somewhere around 1,000 BC, retired corn breeder Forrest Troyer says this early corn was moved into the area we now know as New Mexico and Arizona.
And then dent corn came in after Columbus, probably Cortez, when he went to Tampa Bay, when he went to Tampa Bay, probably brought the first dent corn to the United States.
The critical thing about these two moves was that the corn, flint, and dent had to be adapted to longer days and cooler, shorter seasons. Now, dent has also been developed in Mexico, but much later than flint, probably about 1500 BC, says Troyer. So flint corn came into the southwestern part of the United States, and dent corn traveled much later into the eastern U.S. Dent corn was superior to flint in almost every respect. The kernels were larger and the yields were greater. Soon enough, European settlers in the New World recognized the two different kinds of corn were related and could be crossed.
And the flints were the source of earlier maturity that was needed, and the dents were the source of higher yield and also better feeding traits. So some number of people Virginia and in Tennessee and Kentucky crossed flint by dents to develop varieties.
Generally, says Troyer, it is estimated that by the time most of the United States had been settled, in the 1840s, about 250 different varieties of dent/flint crosses had been developed. The Corn Belt, at that time, still hadn't made its way northward. The prime growing states were Virginia, Kentucky, and Tennessee.
And the reason for that is that the land grants from the Revolutionary War from Virginia, the state of Virginia, and also the land grants that were issued to veterans of the Mexican War were virtually all in that area. There was a small area in southern Ohio on the Scioto River, but there were two areas in Tennessee and there's two areas in Kentucky, and of course the corn in Virginia was already there. I mean, you know that they had already worked with it before the movement west started.
It is the combination of what American Indians did in bringing flint corn north into the U.S. and what European settlers did with dent corn on the East Coast that has resulted in the hybrids grown today by farmers in the new Corn Belt, Nebraska, Iowa, Missouri, Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio. As farmers settled those states, they brought the 250 Dent Flint crosses northwestward with them. Those open-pollinated crosses, the Dent-Flint combinations, were quickly adapted to the growing conditions of the Midwest. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.